Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, February 17th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. As we get started, let's take a look at the weather. Today, it's to be mostly cloudy, with some snow showers in the afternoon. The wind will be southeasterly at 5 to 15 miles per hour, a high of 12, a low of 2 below. Tomorrow, partly sunny, high 14, low 6 below. Friday, partly sunny, high 11, low 3 below. Then on Saturday, increasing clouds, high 21, low 15. Our first story today comes from the front page of the Gazette, written by Kat Russell. Big risks, but few virus cases at area ambulance. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Despite their daily contact with the public in the corridor, only a handful of area ambulance employees have tested positive for COVID-19 since the disease was confirmed in Iowa last March. Keith Rippey, the chief executive officer for Area Ambulance, said, "We had to make a lot of adjustments when the pandemic hit. It affected almost every aspect of our operations and put a substantial increase in demand on our employees. We've never had to worry about personal protective equipment to this extent. We're decontaminating ambulances daily, which we've never had to do before, and we've never had to worry about minimizing contact with the public like we have in the past year." A total of 14 area ambulance employees have tested positive for COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, said Jackie Gillen, the director of operations, and approximately 31 employees have been tested for the virus. A lot of those who tested positive did so during the early months of the pandemic. The ambulance service currently employs about 70 full and part-time emergency medical technicians and paramedics in Linn and Johnson counties, and an additional 10 in Buchanan County, some of whom are volunteer EMTs. The ambulance service covers 250 square miles in Linn County, as well as portions of Johnson and Buchanan counties. In total, the service covers about 600 square miles, said Doug Wohlweber, the manager of quality and compliance. 65 of the 70 full and part-time employees had received both doses of the COVID-19 vaccines as of early February. When the novel coronavirus first appeared in Iowa, area ambulances implemented face mask protocols, ensuring that its EMTs and paramedics were equipped with medical-grade N95 masks, and made sure that every rig was outfitted with adequate PPE, including gloves, face shields, gowns, and masks. Additionally, temperatures were taken at the beginning of each shift, and a 2-week isolation period was required for anyone exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19. But as the number of positive cases began to climb in communities and outbreaks erupted in long-term care facilities across the state, the ambulance service was forced to make further adjustments to minimize employee exposure. Gillen said, "We get a lot of calls from long-term care facilities every day, so when we started getting notified of outbreaks in those facilities, we began asking the faculty staff to bring the patients outside to us whenever possible, and we would meet them at the front door. That way, our people wouldn't have to go inside." With winter in full effect, that procedure changed. The ambulance crews now are asking that the patient be brought to the front door, with the handoff occurring just inside. With facilities that are experiencing significant outbreaks, the ambulance crews began leaving cots and asking the facility staff to load the patient onto that cot and bring that patient to the door where the ambulance crew would collect the patient and leave behind an empty cot. Patients are masked at first contact, regardless of their symptoms or where they are calling from, and whenever possible, patients are asked to meet the responding team outside or just inside the door. When it is necessary to go inside, one person from the 2-unit team will go in first. The second will follow only if needed. Depending on the call, Gillen said the ambulance crew might not be the only unit to show up. Police and fire units might also respond. she said, and in these cases, if we can, we try to save the police or the firefighters from exposure. So, if the police or fire department show up for some reason, and we've determined we don't need their assistance, we'll wave them off. If we know they're going to have to transport, and we know that inevitably we're going to have the exposure, it doesn't make sense to have everybody else come in and risk exposure too. Last year, area ambulance responded to more than 25,000 calls in Linn and Johnson counties and about 1,000 calls in Buchanan County. About 17,000 of all of those resulted in patient transports. Data from area ambulance shows that 1,467 patients were deemed by the dispatch screening process to possibly have COVID-19, and only 414 of those patients actually tested positive. That said, it has been area ambulance's protocol to treat every patient as if he or she were positive for the virus. Gillen said, "I think that's a big part of how we've managed to keep our infection rates low. The other part," she said, "is likely the decontamination protocols. The service hired 2 people to clean the rigs and the equipment at the end of each shift." Gillen said, "We didn't want that all falling on the medics. They had so much on their minds already, and it seemed like a lot to pile on at the end of their already busy and stressful day." The decontamination process starts just outside the area ambulance garage, where crews wash the outside of the rigs and sweep and clean the inside. Then the ambulance is brought inside, and a UV light is placed in the back for 15 to 30 minutes, which, Wallweber said, quote, kills 99% of germs. Then the decontamination specialist takes over, spraying every surface of the rig and all the equipment with an 0.5% hydrogen peroxide solution using an electrostatic sprayer. After that, the rig is ready for its next crew. Gillen said, "We think the process has been wildly successful. You know, I can't outright say this is why our COVID numbers have stayed low, but I do believe it has played a big role in keeping our people safe, and that's always been our biggest concern, the safety of our staff and our patients." In a weather-related front-page story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette, says leaving car to warm up could make it really hot. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids man found out the hard way why it was not such a great idea to leave his vehicle warming up in the cold while he went back inside his apartment to take a shower. He left the sport utility vehicle unattended Monday for 20 minutes in his apartment complex parking lot. When he came back outside, the SUV was gone. Luckily, the man reported the theft immediately, and police found a suspect in the Hyundai Tucson about 30 minutes later on J Street Southwest, Linn County Attorney Jerry Vander Sanden said on Tuesday. "I understand it's tempting, especially in cold weather, to start your car and then go back inside, but these are 2% preventable crimes," Vander Sanden said. "Many times it is a seasonal crime, but locally, there has been a 33% increase in stolen vehicles, and nationally, it's 13%. This is a trend that started last year because people were leaving their keys, or now a key fob, inside an unlocked car." Vander Sanden said, "These are crimes of convenience, meaning the thieves are looking for easy targets. They aren't breaking into cars, just searching for unlocked cars with keys inside." According to Cedar Rapids Police Department statistics, in 2019, 425 vehicles were stolen. Of those, 179 were left unattended and running. In 2020, 565 vehicles were stolen, 250 of which were left unattended and running. And as of Tuesday, there have been 24 vehicles stolen this year. Of those, 19 have been recovered. Nationwide, an early analysis by the National Insurance Crime Bureau shows vehicle thefts took a dramatic leap last year when compared with 2019, reversing 2 years of declines. The initial study showed there were over 873,000 thefts in 2020, a 9.2% increase over 2019. Van der Sanden pointed out 20 incidents in Linn County involving stolen vehicles that turned into eluding cases when the suspects fled from the police. Many resulted in crashes or damages to the vehicles when police used stop sticks to end the chases. There also have been stolen vehicle cases that have resulted in more serious charges because firearms were left in a vehicle, which he noted could end up being used in another crime. Van der Sanden said a state law that subjected people to fines for leaving cars unattended and running was changed. Nonetheless, he says, owners should still take care to not leave unattended vehicles running or leave car doors unlocked with the key fobs inside. Greg Bulow, the Cedar Rapids Police public safety spokesman, said the 103-year-old law that prohibited a vehicle from being left unattended and running was changed in 2017. The law now says it's a violation to leave a vehicle unattended on a grade or hill without setting a brake and turning the wheels to an angle. Bulow said one of the reasons for the change was that vehicles were more commonly becoming equipped with remote ignition starters. Drivers with remote start can warm up the car while it still is locked, but those cars can become a target for thieves if the doors also are unlocked. The National Insurance Crime Bureau recommends 1. Use common sense. Remove keys from the ignition, lock doors and windows, and park in well-lit areas. 2. Install warning devices, including visible and audible alarms. Aftermarket alarms are available for all makes and models. Visual devices include column collars, steering wheel locks, and brake locks. 3. Immobilize devices such as smart keys, fuse cutoffs, kill switches, starter, ignition, and fuel pump disablers, and wireless ignition authentication. And 4, consider tracking devices, which are effective in helping authorities recover stolen vehicles, and some systems combine GPS and wireless technologies to allow remote monitoring. There's a sports-related story on the front page of the Gazette today, written by Vanessa Miller. UI still faces court scrutiny over Title IX in athletics. Dateline, Iowa City. Although University of Iowa Athletics has reversed its decision to eliminate women's swimming and diving after this season, following a court injunction requiring it to do so, the UI hasn't dropped its opposition to the overall court case that could have broader gender equity implications for its student athletes. The university also hasn't directly responded to a Save Hawkeye sports group that has spent months raising $2.5 million from over 700 donors to support the women's swimming and diving program, and 3 other sports still set to be cut after this season: men's tennis, men's gymnastics, and men's swimming and diving. According to a February 5th letter the group sent to UNI Athletics Director Gary Barta and other administrators, spelling out a plan to reinstate the programs, including a commitment to raise another $3 million over 3 years, we are in a time where there is a unique combination of technology and urgency among the donors who have pledged to our cause. We look forward to hearing from you by close of business on Tuesday, February 16, 2021. Administration did not respond to that letter. But on Monday, Barta permanently reinstated women's swimming and diving, the sport who's at the center of a lawsuit accusing the UI of being out of compliance with Title IX, which is the federal gender equity law requiring female athletes have sports opportunities proportionate to their representation in the student body. Barta acknowledged the Save Hawkeye Sports Group Tuesday during a news conference, insisting its fundraising and planning fall short of addressing a $50 million to $60 million coronavirus-created deficit. He said the decision to cut the men's programs to save money unfortunately stands. Barta said, "We made it clear from the beginning that we couldn't just come up with a short-term solution. Whatever solution, if it weren't ever found, would have to address this bigger financial challenge. 50 to 60 million? We'll be working through this and challenged with this probably for the next decade." Citing the September lawsuit, BARDA said the UI continues to disagree with its claims and the judge's order, compelling the campus to continue offering the women's sport while the case works through the court. He said in a statement, "The women's program is being reinstated to quell uncertainty about its fate while the matter awaits a final judgment." Lawyer James LaRue, representing the four female Hawkeye swimmers who filed the lawsuit, along with a UI female rugby player and UI female wrestler who joined, said BARDA is losing disingenuous, or rather being disingenuous. LaRue said, "What caused the uncertainty is an unlawful cutting of the team, and the UI's repeated statements up to the moment of the court's injunctive order that the decision was final, followed by their appeal of that order. That's what has caused all the uncertainty." The women are continuing their lawsuit because of their larger contention that the UI is out of compliance with Title IX, according to LaRue, who said, "I've gone to cut a viable, venerable women's team, and I decided it was a stupid policy decision, in my client's opinion, but that's not why they filed the lawsuit. Our brave clients have challenged their university because, in their view, the team-cutting decision was unlawful. Our clients have alleged that at the moment UI administrators made the decision to cut the women's team, the institution was not in compliance with Title IX. LaRue noted a U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie Rose's December order acknowledging the women had a fair chance at winning the overall case in court. She wrote, in granting an injunction against eliminating women's swimming and diving, that the numbers do not lie. Plaintiffs have demonstrated a fair chance that the University of Iowa does not presently provide its female students with intercollegiate athletic opportunities in substantial proportion to their enrollment, and is unlikely to do so after eliminating the women's swimming and diving team for the 2021-22 academic year. LaRue said he doesn't know whether UI's latest decision to reinstate the women's program would affect the judge's decision on the university's motion to dismiss the case altogether or its appeal of the injunction, but he called the UI decision to reinstate the program smart. He said, "I can only imagine that someone in the bowels of that university might have said, you know, this isn't going to get any better for us. We're doing great damage to the team. Coach Mark Long can't possibly recruit. We've lost some of our very best swimmers already. This team has been badly damaged, and the damage will continue into the long term if Mark Long can't go out and recruit." Supporters of the men's program, still set to be cut, said they can't say the same thing after spending months fundraising and meeting with some members of the UI administration about a new sustainable model for the Hawkeye Olympic sports. Gary Barta and UI President Bruce Harreld have consistently refused to meet with or have serious discussions with those from Save Hawkeye Sports, UI swimmer, and Save Hawkeye Sports member Mark Kaufman told the Gazette, criticizing Monday's announcement about reinstating the women's program. "In fact," Kaufman said, "it is Judge Rose who achieved this, not the leadership in Iowa. This can be proven by the fact that he has not withdrawn the request to the judge to dismiss, nor has he promised the women athletes, coaches, and other supporting members of the team more than what the judge has required." In announcing the program eliminations in August, BARDA cited a pandemic-fueled deficit of $75 million, which he lowered after the resurrection of a fall football season and departmental cost-cutting. But, Kaufman said, UI officials haven't responded to requests for details. "It makes no sense to me to continue to stand behind comments of a large deficit while not providing detail around specifics related to the savings incurred from the furlough program or an overall strategy to manage through this, all the while we are offering to help financially over the long term." Turning now to the Iowa Today page, a story written by Ryan J. Foley, "Corruption Case That Snared Town Officials Dates to 2013. Dateline, Iowa City. Years of government corruption preceded the arrests of five officials from a small northwestern Iowa city, including the mayor and police chief, according to prosecutors and a state audit. The Armstrong officials embezzled tens of thousands of dollars in public funds, falsified public records to conceal wrongdoing, and used city property for personal gain, prosecutors allege, in a charging document that details allegations dating to 2013. The arrests stunned the community of 900 people, which is near Iowa's border with Minnesota and about 40 miles from the popular Okoboji vacation area in the state's northwestern corner. Defense lawyers said they were trying to learn what prompted authorities to act against the officials now, years after some of the alleged misconduct became public in a September 2017 audit report. In another Iowa Today story, written by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette, victim in Iowa City shooting identified. Dateline, Iowa City. Iowa City police have identified the victim in Friday's homicide. Police said Quincy H. Russum, age 19, of Iowa City, was shot and killed in the 600 block of South Governor Street. Police were called to an apartment building at 7:54 p.m. Friday for a report of a shooting. There, officers found Russum's body. A witness told police three men had entered the residence, shot Russum, and fled. Police said the shooting was not random, but the specifics of the homicide still are under investigation. They do not think there is a threat to the public. The death is Iowa City's first homicide in about 10 months, making it the first of 2021. Police have not announced any arrests in the case, which remains under investigation. Iowa City Area Crime Stoppers is offering a reward of up to $1,000 for information leading to an arrest. In another police-related story, written by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette, Iowa City Council wants police feedback on tear gas report. Dateline, Iowa City. After getting a chance to review the investigation into the use of tear gas and flashbangs against protesters last summer, the Iowa City City Council now wants to hear from law enforcement and the city manager. Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague said Tuesday, "When I'm reading this, I don't have the expert knowledge. I think certainly the community is welcome to weigh in. I also think that we should ask our chief of police to weigh in on this and see what the recommendations are from them." Last month, the OIR group released its report on the June 3rd protest that escalated to Iowa City police officers using crowd control devices on protesters trying to access Interstate 80. The report included 39 recommendations, including training, clarifying mutual aid agreements with other law enforcement agencies, and communicating better with demonstrators in the future. City Council member Susan Mims agreed with Teague that the council lacks the knowledge of how law enforcement operates. She said discussing communication issues and practices relating to responding to protests need that expertise. Mims said, "I think it's really important we hear from law enforcement." The council yesterday supported having both Chief Dustin Liston and City Manager Jeff Fruin go through each of the 39 recommendations with the idea of implementing an overreaching goal of keeping the public and police safe while maximizing communication and minimizing conflict. Mayor Pro Tem Mazahir Saleh said she had unspecified concerns with the report and was putting a greater emphasis on the public's recommendations for moving forward rather than law enforcement's. Saleh said, "I want to hear it from the people who have been affected by the issue." The council did give some thoughts to the report yesterday. Councilmember John Thomas said he was most struck by the decision to block access to I-80 by the Iowa State Patrol, which was out of line with the consistent flexibility and discretion up to that point shown by Iowa City Police. Thomas said the decision to deny access to the interstate really put the tone and structure of the demonstration into a different format. Councilmember Pauline Taylor said the report made clear that communication, both between police and protesters and among law enforcement, was ineffective throughout the night. Other council members noted that a large number of OJR's recommendations dealt with communications. Taylor says this is something that definitely warrants further thoughts and planning. Mims said the OJR Group report put the demonstration into a greater context. She noted officers involved in the response had never been involved in a demonstration of that magnitude. She said, "I think we had a lot of people who worked on this who had never worked on something like this before." City leaders now have 39 OJR Group recommendations, 36 recommendations from Fruin's preliminary plan to restructure the police department, and 22 proposed changes to the Community Police Review Board to consider. Fruin said it's going to take time to work through these different sets of recommendations, and discussion on police interactions with protesters needs to happen sooner rather than later. On the Insight page today, we have a guest column written by Tina Patterson, a clinic therapist with Tanger Place. She says play can be crucial to our mental health. Want to come out and play? This earnest childhood invitation to engage with friends is recognized around the world by people of all ages. Play comes naturally for most children because it is their chosen language to communicate. Children start to play when they are infants, connecting with their world through movement and discovering how their bodies move. As a child ages, they engage in various types of play as they observe and interact with others. Language, social, and motor developments are enhanced by both directed and free play. It's crucial to our mental health as well. Play is not just for kids anymore, and it can be the secret weapon to stay young at heart. Interacting with others and opening ourselves up to enjoying activities in the present moment allows us to enhance our closest relationships as well as develop new ones. When parents model positive social skills during the play, kids can learn new skills and enhance the ones they have, like taking turns and having patience. Play, in many forms, helps improve brain function, from puzzles and memory games to physical play that gets the old heart pumping. That old myth that the brain is set at a young age is completely false. Neuroplasticity is the concept that our brain keeps growing and changing throughout our lifetime. Neural pathways are stimulated through play activities and can create new synaptic connections. Creativity gets a boost from play, where we create, move, make decisions, and use our imagination in something like Dungeons and Dragons, an imaginary tea party, or even a 30-second dance party. Sharing fun helps us develop compassion, sympathy, trust, and intimacy. One major intersection of play and mental health wellness is the use of play therapy by a licensed therapist or clinician. Play therapy takes all of the vital aspects brought about by adding play to our lives and uses them to assist clients in improving their lives. Through observing and engaging in play, the therapist can connect and communicate with the client using the signs, symbols, and actions of the client's play to assess needs. Using creative arts such as clay, sand, music, and paint, a play therapist can engage in ways that traditional talk therapy might not be able to reach. Play therapy is not limited to children or teens. Adults can benefit immensely by allowing their playful, expressive side access a different avenue for healing and positive mental health. Play is not only the prescription for healing, it is the mode for learning more about the challenges faced by the client. Play is a crucial part of who we are as humans. It is how we first communicate, and it is how we engage parts of ourselves that are lost in the busy everyday schedules we keep. So the next time you're feeling stressed and overwhelmed, ask yourself, when was the last time you played? Really played? It might be a game of catch. It might be building a snowman or playing a video game. It could be engaging in a creative outlet like music, or as simple as breaking out the Uno deck and asking your family to join you in some fun and games. Let's all take this challenge. As we are in Play Therapy Awareness Month, find a way to slip some play into your everyday life. How about we turn to each other and ask, "Wanna play?" Now, go have some fun. It's a healthy thing to do, and you just might like it. That's from Tina Patterson, a clinic therapist with Tanger Place. And on the inside page, we have a community letter today from Ken Bowen of Iowa City. The headline says, Iowa needs a moratorium on new livestock confinements. Ken says, Iowa needs a moratorium on new and expanding CAFOs. I am not suggesting totally disbanding an entire industry. I am only asking everyone to take a step back, catch a breath, and look to see who really benefits from the overall effects of this industry. Do family farmers benefit from the industrialization of agriculture? Do people benefit from the industrialization of agriculture? Does our land benefit from the industrialization of agriculture? There is a better way. Let's work together so we all benefit from agriculture and animal husbandry. A moratorium would be the best option to get started on that way. 63% of Iowans across party lines want a moratorium on factory farms. Yet, Iowa House Speaker Grassley says that the Factors Farms Moratorium Bill is DOA. No one legislator should stifle debate on legislation, especially with such wide public support. H.F. 440 should be put before a subcommittee for discussion. Call Speaker of the House Pat Grassley. Pat's phone number is 515-281-3221, and share why a moratorium is worth supporting, and demand he push for a subcommittee in the House. Demand he allow discussion of a moratorium by members of both parties. And that's today's community letter from Ken Bowen of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, February 17th. The Iowa Radio Reading Information Service from the Blind, IRIS. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, today's other notices, and there are a number of them. From Cedar Rapids, Donna Jean Robbins, age 91, died yesterday. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids will assist the family. From Decorah, Jane Onsen Bullard, age 87, died Saturday, February 13th. The Gelstead Funeral Home of Decorah is in charge of the arrangements. Also from Decorah, Mary Ann Madrigal, age 85, died Thursday, February 11th. Again, the Gelstead Funeral Home of Decorah will assist the family. From Delhi, Savannah Rose Domeyer, age 26, of Dubuque, formerly of Delhi, died Sunday, February 14th. The Leonard Muller Funeral Home of Edgewood will assist the family. From Hiawatha, Max Freeman Warren, age 82, died Monday, February 15th. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is in charge of those arrangements. From Iowa City, Douglas Arthur Vett, age 87, died Monday. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service of Iowa City will assist the family. From Monona, Robert Frederick Drawn, age 93, died Monday. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Monona is in charge of those arrangements. From Sigourney, Mildred Kleinschmidt Abel, age 93, died Saturday, February 13th. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is in charge of those arrangements. From Spillville, Gloria Mashick, age 74, of Bettendorf, formerly of Spillville, died Thursday, February 11th. The Schluter Bayhack Funeral Home of Decorah will assist the family. Also from Spillville, Alice Puffer, age 93, died Monday, February 15th. The Schluter Bayhack Funeral Home of Decorah is in charge of those arrangements as well. From Tipton, Frances Darlene Thuma, age 96, died Monday. The Fry Funeral Home of Tipton will assist the family. And from Wheatland, Carolyn Bauer, age 85, died Monday. The Chapman Funeral Home of Clarence will assist the family there. Turning to the more extensive funeral announcements, Clarence J. Walton, age 71, of Cedar Rapids, died on February 14th. Celebration of life and burial will be at a later date. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services of Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association, the American Heart Association, or to a charity of your choice. Joseph Davis, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Private family services will be held invitation only. All invited guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. A public celebration of life will be held at a later date when family and friends can gather safely to raise a glass and share stories for a proper Irish send-off. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Memorials may be directed to the family, who will disperse to Joe's favorite organizations. The family would like to thank the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House for their loving compassion. Slatko Hayden, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, February 15th. A visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Friday, February 19th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Gladys Maxine Jones, age 97, of Marion, formerly of Center Point, passed away this past Saturday in the Ed and Joan Hemphill Hospice Unit within St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private family interment will be held at Alice Cemetery in rural Center Point at a later date. Mary Teresa Johnson of Cedar Rapids died February 15th at home in Cedar Rapids. The family will be holding a visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, tomorrow, at Cedar Memorial. Following the continued guidance from health officials, physical distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. Rhonda M. Kratz of Cedar Rapids died Sunday, February 14th, at the age of 70. A celebration of life will be held at a later time. In lieu of flowers or monetary contributions, you are being asked to please reach out to the people you hold dear to your heart and create lasting memories together. When our time on earth is done, it will be those memories we cherish forever. Also on the obituaries, Thomas J. Toner, age 81, a longtime resident of the area and former 32-year veteran of the Iowa State Patrol, died Monday at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Memorial services will be held at 10 o'clock Saturday morning at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Iowa City. The services can also be viewed through the live streaming feature on the funeral home's website. That's the Gay and Chia Funeral Home. M. Helen Harton, age 94, of Williamsburg, passed away Monday at Highland Ridge Care Center in Williamsburg. A private family mass of Christian burial will be held. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery in Marengo. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 19th, at the Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo. Memorials may be contributed to St. Mary's Catholic Church in Williamsburg or to the Holden Comprehensive Care Cancer Center in Iowa City. Donald E. Lehman, age 82, from Iowa City, a longtime area educator, died Monday at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock Friday morning at St. Andrew Presbyterian Church in Iowa City, where there will be a time of visitation 1 hour before the services. The services can also be viewed by family and friends through the live streaming feature on the funeral home website, gayandchia.com. In lieu of flowers, Don's family encourages memorial donations to the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County to continue to support the compassionate care they provided for Don and his family. And finally, Sally Jo Craig, age 83, of Robbins, died February 13th at Emery Place in Robbins. All services will be private. Burial in Mount Hope Cemetery in Independence, a celebration of life, will be planned for a later date. Turning now to sports, there's a story written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. Warriors top West, first time since 11. Dateline, Iowa City. One guy is going to get stitches. Another guy will have to get checked for a concussion before being allowed to play or practice again. A third guy already was injured in practice and sat out. Battered but not beaten, could best describe these Cedar Rapids Washington Warriors after they literally toughed out a 57-55 boys basketball road win last night at Iowa City West. This is Wash's first victory since 2011 over a school that has had the longest run of success in Class 4A in the state over the last decade or so. West has multiple state championships and has been a state tourney qualifier 10 years in a row, but it's a bit of a down year for the Trojans, who are now 4-7, thanks to a pretty inexperienced lineup and a couple of COVID-19 pauses that have hampered development. But that's not going to make this win any less special for the 12-7 Washington Warriors. The last time Wash beat West was when Wes Washburn, the former UNI star and professional player in the U.S. and Europe, banked in a running 30-footer at the horn. That was January 4th, 2011. Washington coach Justin Decker said, "I knew it's been a while, a long time." "They've been in a slump because of COVID," said Washington's Trajan Sane, one of three sophomore starters on this team. "They've been off twice, but it's still a good feeling coming in and getting a win like this, especially heading into sub-state. We're trying to build up as much momentum as possible." Proclivity from beyond the arc was the reason West led most of this game. The Trojans were 10 of 19 from deep, while freshman Kareem Earl splashed 4 in a 16-point night, and 6'8" junior center Pete Moe knocked down a pair in a game-high 19-point performance. Leading scorer Quincy Underwood sat most of the first half after butting heads with a West defender. He came back in midway through the third quarter. Sophomore guard Jesse Sellers led Washington with 14 points, followed closely by Sane with 13 and Underwood with 11. Washington is the second seed in a 4A sub-state that features top-ranked Cedar Falls. The postseason begins for 3A and 4A clubs on Monday. In other regular season boys games yesterday, Cedar Rapids Kennedy beat Iowa City Liberty 59-43. Dubuque Senior was all over Cedar Rapids Prairie 85-62. Iowa City High got by Cedar Rapids Jefferson 65-56. Linmar nipped Cedar Rapids Xavier 60-58. It was Marion over Vinton Shelsburg 60-49. Clear Creek Comana topped Benton Community 76-74. Mount Vernon defeated Waverly Shellrock 54-51. And it was Solon over Center Point Urbana 60-54. In girls' Class 2A regional quarterfinal tournament games last night, West Branch fell 75-41 to Danville. Regina advanced by beating Mediapolis 54-49. North Lynn topped Hudson 64-50. Albernett dropped a 53-42 decision to Waterloo Columbus, and Walton beat Durant 47-43. In Class 1A girls' regional quarterfinals, Springville got by Lisbon 70-34. In a girls' regional tournament matchup preview for tonight, Jeff Linder of the Gazette says Linmar versus Prairie, a true regional toss-up. "You couldn't get two more evenly matched teams," Cedar Rapids Prairie girls coach Josh Bentley said. "The first time we got lucky and held on. They've improved, and hopefully we've improved too." And there's this from Linmar coach Chad Tompkins. "We're two evenly matched teams. There are a lot of similarities," he said. "Neither of us have a double-digit score, but are both really balanced. It should go down to the wire." Prairie at 8-8 hosts Linmar at 9-8 in a Class 5A regional semifinal tonight at 7 o'clock. Their records couldn't be much more similar, and neither can their recent history. Prairie prevailed in their regular season meeting 45-42 back on January 12th at Linmar. Tompkins said, "It's probably going to come down to one or two possessions again." Linmar is a veteran crew. Caitlin Brunson at 9.1 points per game, Hallie Peak at 8.6, and Kevin Krejci, 7.2, lead a class of 9 seniors on this varsity roster, and the Lions have been aided by the emergence of sophomore Zoe Kennedy, who's averaging 9 points and 7.4 rebounds per game. Prairie counters with a roster blended with experience and youth. Seniors Hallie Cooper and Natalie Bennett averaged 9.3 and 7.8 points, respectively, and Katie Rettinger leads a talented freshman class. 5 ninth graders are in the Hawks' regular rotation. Bentley said, "Natalie and Haley have grown a lot. They have been in a supportive role until this year, and now they've had to learn to use their voice. Elsewhere in Iowa tonight, Cedar Rapids Kennedy takes his 13-8 record against Iowa City Liberty, who's 4-11 in the 5A quarterfinal. And 12-8 Marion is heavily favored to handle Clinton 0-16 in a 4A contest. Kennedy, without debate, is the hottest Metro team at the moment. The Cougars have won 12 of their last 15. Cougars coach Andy Courtney said, "Defense has really turned us around. This absolutely is the best stretch of my 3 years here." Sophia Barrett and Kaylee Sain, there are two leaders. They handle the ball and take a lot of the shots. But if we were going to jump to the next level, they had to bring the other girls up. It didn't have to be on their shoulders. The 3A regional semifinals are tonight, with winners playing for state tournament berths Saturday. Among area ranked teams, number 9 West Liberty hosts Centerville, number 10 Center Point Urbana welcomes Davenport Assumption, number 12 Solon entertains number 15 Monticello, number 13 Vinton Shellsburg will host Williamsburg, and number 14 Waukon welcomes North Fayette Valley. The State High School Wrestling Dual Championships get underway today at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. In Class 3A, Waverly Shellrock will take on Linmar. Fort Dodge will go up against North Scott. Southeast Polk takes on Norwalk. Waukee goes up against Bettendorf. In Class 2A, West Delaware tangles with Sergeant Bluff Luton. Davenport Assumption takes on Independence. Crestwood goes up against Creston, and it'll be Winterset against Osage. In Class 1A, Don Bosco takes on MFL Marmac. Lake Mills will go up against Woodbury Central. Lisbon will take on West Hancock. Logan Magnolia wrestles with West Sioux, with all championship duels starting at 6:30 tonight. Turning to the business page, there's a story written by John Steppe of the Gazette, BAE NAVS Space Force Contract. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. BAE Systems received a $247 million contract from the U.S. Space Force to build global positioning system chips and receivers in Cedar Rapids. The company made that announcement in a news release. The United Kingdom-based company will manufacture the chips and receivers at the $139 million classified aerospace defense facility under construction on 76th Avenue Southwest and 6th Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. The GPS units use M-code technology, which has stronger anti-spoofing and anti-jamming technology than what's in older GPS units. Greg Wild, the Director of Navigation and Sensor Systems at BAE Systems, in the release said, "This program enables us to further develop our core M-code technology to deliver high-performance, next-generation GPS capabilities." He says our M-code receiver and next-gen ASIC will enable secure and reliable military GPS capabilities in a broader range of platforms. BAE Systems acquired Collins Aerospace military GPS business in Cedar Rapids in July after federal regulators asked Collins Aerospace to divest the business unit as part of its parent company, United Technologies Corp's merger with Raytheon Company. Also in July, BAE Systems brought forth plans for the new facility that will keep about 700 jobs in the corridor. Also on the business page, a story written by Brooklyn Drawlsy says National Park Service opens historical houses for lease. Brooklyn says the union, the National Park Service, is giving entrepreneurs the opportunity to open private businesses on public land with three historical houses up for lease at the Herbert Hoover National Historic Site in West Branch. The service has asked for requests for expression of interest from businesses for adaptive uses of the three houses. The Staples House is estimated at 2,100 square feet, the Wright House at 1,440 square feet, and the Hayhurst House at 1,700 square feet, and all are located within the park's historic district. All three houses were built in the 1870s, and Superintendent Peter Swisher said they had been used as short-term housing for employees, along with three other houses. The service decided to put these houses up for lease because the need for employee housing has decreased over the years. Swisher said it's better for houses as old as these to keep them active rather than letting them sit dormant for long periods of time. Swisher said, "For us, it was really an evaluation of what we need in our inventory for potential use by employees versus what we think we have potentially in surplus." Potential businesses moving into the houses must fit with the atmosphere of the historical site, Swisher said. Businesses such as offices or inns that don't detract from the area, as, for example, a nightclub would. The site commemorates former President Herbert Hoover's birthplace in West Branch. Swisher said that never let a business venture get in the way of the park telling the Hoover story. Once people show interest in the properties, the National Park Service will conduct a market analysis to determine the appropriate rental income for houses of these sizes. Swisher estimated the Staples House rental price at around $1,100 a month and the two smaller houses at around $700 to $800 a month. The next step, after REIs come in for the National Park Service to put out a public notice describing the type of proposal it requires, then allow prospective businesses to make bids and enter a leasing agreement. As the site lies adjacent to downtown West Branch, Swisher said he hopes opening businesses in the area will bring visitors to both the site and the town. The goal here, he said, isn't competition, but collaborations. Swisher added, "We're hoping that the park and businesses downtown can succeed through this. It's an all boats rise at the same level type of thing." In today's COVID-19 story, written by Gage Miskimum of the Gazette, Iowa reported 398 new COVID-19 cases and 26 new confirmed deaths yesterday. That brings the state's total infections to 329,813 and confirmed deaths to over 5,200, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data. Iowa's 7-day average for new cases is 633, the lowest number since August 25th. Yesterday's new cases come from over 10,000 new individuals tested, the highest number since November 20th. Linn County added 31 new cases in the 24-hour period ending at 11 o'clock yesterday morning, bringing the county total to just over 19,000. The county's 7-day average is 31. Johnson County reported 22 new cases, with a total of 12,851. The 7-day average in Johnson County is 22. Of the state's new cases, 94 were of individuals aged 0 to 17, bringing the total number of minors infected with COVID-19 in Iowa to almost 37,000. Across the state, hospitalizations due to COVID-19 went from 242 to 255 in that 24-hour period. Patients in the ICU remained at 57, and the number of patients on ventilators went from 28 down to 25. As of yesterday, 28 of Iowa's long-term care facilities were experiencing COVID-19 outbreaks. Within those facilities, 769 individuals were infected with the virus. Since the start of the pandemic, 2,120 people in facilities have died. Lantern Park Specialty Care in Coralville remained at 44 cases and added one new recovery, for a total of 37. As of 12:30 yesterday afternoon, the total number of COVID-19 vaccine doses in the state was almost 497,000, with 477,000 being administered to Iowa residents, according to state data. The number of people receiving a first dose was just over 245,000, with 125,000 completing the two-dose series. In Linn County, 33,634 doses have been administered. Almost 9,000 have completed the vaccine, or 5.15% of the whole county. In Johnson County, 36,058 doses have been administered, with just over 11,000, or 9.34% of the county, completing the vaccine. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, February 17th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home, so take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.